The sky was turquoise blue, like a lake with gold light throbbing in it. Higher up, in the utter clarity of the western slope, the evening star hung like a lamp suspended by silver chains, like the lamp engraved upon the title page of old Latin texts, which is always appearing in new heavens and waking new desires in men. It reminded me, at any rate, to shut my window and light my wick in answer. I did so regretfully, and the dim objects in the room emerged from the shadows and took their place about me with the helpfulness which custom breeds. I propped my book open and stared listlessly at the page of the Georgics where tomorrow's lesson began. It opened with the melancholy reflection that, in the lives of mortals, the best days are the first to flee. Optima dies, prima fugit. I turned back to the beginning of the third book, which we had read in class that morning. Primus ego in patriam mecum. Deducam musas. For I shall be the first, if I live, to bring the muse into my country. Cleric had explained to us that patria here meant not a nation or even a province, but the little rural neighborhood on the Mincio where the poet was born. This was not a boast, but a hope, at once bold and devoutly humble, that he might bring the muse, but lately come to Italy from her cloudy Grecian mountains, not to the capital, the Palatia Romana, but to his own little country, to his father's fields, sloping down to the river and to the old beech trees with broken tops. Cleric said he thought Virgil, when he was dying at Brindisi, must have remembered that passage. After he had faced the bitter fact that he was to leave the Aeneid unfinished, and had decreed that the great canvas, crowded with figures of gods and men, should be burned rather than survive him unperfected, then his mind must have gone back to the perfect utterance of the Georgics, where the pen was fitted to the matter as the plough is to the furrow. And he must have said to himself, with the thankfulness of a good man, "I was the first to bring the muse into my country." We left the classroom quietly, conscious that we had been brushed by the wing of a great feeling, though perhaps I alone knew Cleric intimately enough to guess what that feeling was. In the evening, as I sat staring at my book, the fervor of his voice stirred through the quantities on the page before me. I was wondering whether that particular rocky strip of New England coast about which he had so often told me was Cleric's patria. Before I had got far with my reading, I was disturbed by a knock. I hurried to the door, and when I opened it, saw a woman standing in the dark hall. "I expect you hardly know me, Jim." The voice seemed familiar, but I did not recognize her until she stepped into the light of my doorway, and I beheld Lena Lingard. She was so quietly conventionalized by city clothes that I might have passed her on the street without seeing her. Her black suit fitted her figure smoothly, and the black lace hat with pale blue forget-me-nots sat demurely on her yellow hair. I led her toward Cleric's chair, the only comfortable one I had, questioning her confusedly. She was not disconcerted by my embarrassment. She looked about her with the naive curiosity I remembered so well. "You are quite comfortable here, aren't you? I live in Lincoln now, too, Jim. I'm in business for myself. I have a dressmaking shop in the Raleigh block out on O Street. I've made a real good start." "But, Lena, when did you come?" "Oh, I've been here all winter. Didn't your grandmother ever write you? I thought about looking you up lots of times, but we've all heard what a studious young man you've got to be, and I felt bashful. I didn't know whether you'd be glad to see me." She laughed her mellow, easy laugh that was either very artless or very comprehending, one never quite knew which. "You seem the same, though, except you're a young man now, of course. Do you think I've changed? Maybe you're prettier, though you were always pretty enough. Perhaps it's your clothes that make a difference." "You like my new suit? I have to dress pretty well in my business." She took off her jacket and sat more at ease in her blouse of some soft, flimsy silk. She was already at home in my place, had slipped quietly into it as she did into everything. She told me her business was going well and she had saved a little money. "This summer I'm going to build the house for Mother I've talked about so long. I won't be able to pay up on it at first, but I want her to have it before she is too old to enjoy it. Next summer I'll take her down new furniture and carpets, so she'll have something to look forward to all winter." I watched Lena sitting there so smooth and sunny and well cared for, and thought of how she used to run barefoot over the prairie until after the snow began to fly, and how Crazy Mary chased her round and round the cornfields. It seemed to me wonderful that she should have got on so well in the world. Certainly she had no one but herself to thank for it. "You must feel proud of yourself, Lena," I said heartily. "Look at me. I've never earned a dollar, and I don't know that I'll ever be able to."
"Tony says you're going to be richer than Mr. Harling someday. She's always bragging about you, you know."
"Tell me, how is Tony?"
"She's fine. She works for Mrs. Gardner at the hotel now. She's housekeeper. Mrs. Gardner's health isn't what it was, and she can't see after everything like she used to. She has great confidence in Tony. Tony's made it up with the Harlings, too. Little Nina is so fond of her that Mrs. Harling kind of overlooked things."
"Is she still going with Larry Donovan?"
"Oh, that's on. Worse than ever. I guess they're engaged. Tony talks about him like he was president of the railroad. Everybody laughs about it because she was never a girl to be soft. She won't hear a word against him. She's so sort of innocent."
I said I didn't like Larry and never would. Lena's face dimpled.
"Some of us could tell her things, but it wouldn't do any good. She'd always believe him. That's Antonia's failing, you know. If she once likes people, she won't hear anything against them."
"I think I'd better go home and look after Antonia," I said.
"I think you had." Lena looked up at me in frank amusement. "It's a good thing the Harlings are friendly with her again. Larry's afraid of them. They ship so much grain they have influence with the railroad people. What are you studying?"
She leaned her elbows on the table and drew my book toward her.
"So that's Latin, is it? It looks hard. You do go to the theater sometimes, though, for I've seen you there. Don't you just love a good play, Jim? I can't stay at home in the evening if there's one in town. I'd be willing to work like a slave, it seems to me, to live in a place where there are theaters."
"Let's go to a show together sometime. You're going to let me come to see you, aren't you?"
"Would you like to? I'd be ever so pleased. I'm never busy after 6 o'clock, and I let my sewing girls go at 5:30. I board to save time, but sometimes I cook a chop for myself, and I'd be glad to cook one for you. Well," she began to put on her white gloves, "it's been awful good to see you, Jim."
"You needn't hurry, need you? You've hardly told me anything yet."
"We can talk when you come to see me. I expect you don't often have lady visitors. The old woman downstairs didn't want to let me come up very much. I told her I was from your hometown and had promised your grandmother to come and see you. How surprised Mrs. Burden would be." Lena laughed softly as she rose. When I caught up my hat, she shook her head. "No, I don't want you to go with me. I'm to meet some Swedes at the drugstore. You wouldn't care for them. I wanted to see your room so I could write Tony all about it, but I must tell her how I left you right here with your books. She's always so afraid someone will run off with you." Lena slipped her silk sleeves into the jacket I held for her, smoothed it over her person, and buttoned it slowly. I walked with her to the door.
"Come and see me sometimes when you're lonesome. But maybe you have all the friends you want, have you?"
She turned her soft cheek to me.
"Have you?"
she whispered teasingly in my ear. In a moment I watched her fade down the dusky stairway. When I turned back to my room, the place seemed much pleasanter than before. Lena had left something warm and friendly in the lamplight. How I loved to hear her laugh again! It was so soft and unexcited and appreciative, gave a favorable interpretation to everything. When I closed my eyes, I could hear them all laughing, the Danish laundry girls and the three Bohemian Marys. Lena had brought them all back to me. It came over me as it had never done before, the relation between girls like those and the poetry of Virgil. If there were no girls like them in the world, there would be no poetry. I understood that clearly for the first time. This revelation seemed to me inestimably precious. I clung to it as if it might suddenly vanish. As I sat down to my book at last, my old dream about Lena coming across the harvest field in her short skirt seemed to me like the memory of an actual experience. It floated before me on the page like a picture, and underneath it stood the mournful line, "Optima dies, prima fugit."
Chapter 3. In Lincoln, the best part of the theatrical season came late, when the good company stopped off there for one-night stands after their long runs in New York and Chicago. That spring, Lena went with me to see Joseph Jefferson in Rip Van Winkle and to a war play called Shenandoah. She was inflexible about paying for her own seat, said she was in business now, and she wouldn't have a schoolboy spending his money on her. I liked to watch a play with Lena. Everything was wonderful to her, and everything was true.
It was like going to revival meetings with someone who was always being converted. She handed her feelings over to the actors with a kind of fatalistic resignation. Accessories of costume and scene meant much more to her than to me. She sat entranced through Robin Hood and hung upon the lips of the contralto who sang, "Oh, Promise Me." Toward the end of April, the billboards, which I watched anxiously in those days, bloomed out one morning with gleaming white posters on which two names were impressively printed in blue Gothic letters. The name of an actress of whom I had often heard, and the name Camille. I called at the Raleigh Block for Lena on Saturday evening, and we walked down to the theater. The weather was warm and sultry and put us both in a holiday humor. We arrived early because Lena liked to watch the people come in. There was a note on the program saying that the incidental music would be from the opera Traviata, which was made from the same story as the play. We had neither of us read the play, and we did not know what it was about, though I seem to remember having heard it was a piece in which great actresses shone. The Count of Monte Cristo, which I had seen James O'Neill play that winter, was by the only Alexandre Dumas I knew. This play, I saw, was by his son, and I expected a family resemblance. A couple of jackrabbits running off the prairie could not have been more innocent of what awaited them than were Lena and I. Our excitement began with the rise of the curtain, when the moody Varville, seated before the fire, interrogated Nanine. Decidedly, there was a new tang about this dialogue. I had never heard in the theater lines that were alive, that presupposed and took for granted, like those which passed between Varville and Marguerite in the brief encounter before her friends entered. This introduced the most brilliant, worldly, the most enchantingly gay scene I had ever looked upon. I had never seen champagne bottles opened on the stage before. Indeed, I had never seen them opened anywhere. The memory of that supper makes me hungry now. The sight of it then, when I had only a student's boarding-house dinner behind me, was delicate torment. I seem to remember gilded chairs and tables, arranged hurriedly by footmen in white gloves and stockings. Linen of dazzling whiteness, glittering glass, silver dishes, a great bowl of fruit, and the reddest of roses. The room was invaded by beautiful women and dashing young men, laughing and talking together. The men were dressed more or less after the period in which the play was written. The women were not. I saw no inconsistency. Their talk seemed to open to one the brilliant world in which they lived. Every sentence made one older and wiser. Every pleasantry enlarged one's horizon. One could experience excess and satiety without the inconvenience of learning what to do with one's hands in a drawing room. When the characters all spoke at once, and I missed some of the phrases they flashed at each other, I was in misery. I strained my ears and eyes to catch every exclamation. The actress who played Marguerite was even then old-fashioned, though historic. She had been a member of Daly's famous New York company, and afterward a star under his direction. She was a woman who could not be taught, it is said, though she had a crude natural force which carried with people whose feelings were accessible and whose taste was not squeamish. She was already old, with a ravaged countenance and a physique curiously hard and stiff. She moved with difficulty. I think she was lame. I seem to remember some story about a malady of the spine. Her Armand was disproportionately young and slight, a handsome youth, perplexed in the extreme. But what did it matter? I believed devoutedly in her power to fascinate him, in her dazzling loveliness. I believed her young, ardent, reckless, disillusioned, under sentence, feverish, avid of pleasure. I wanted to cross the footlights and help the slim-waisted Armand in the frilled shirt to convince her that there was still loyalty and devotion in the world. Her sudden illness, when the gaiety was at its height, her pallor, the handkerchief she crushed against her lips, the cough she smothered under the laughter while Gaston kept playing the piano lightly, it all wrung my heart, but not so much as her cynicism in the long dialogue with her lover which followed. How far was I from questioning her unbelief? While the charmingly sincere young man pleaded with her, accompanied by the orchestra and the old Traviata duet, "Misteroso, misteros, altero," she maintained her bitter skepticism, and the curtain fell on her dancing recklessly with the others after Armand had been sent away with his flower. Between the acts we had no time to forget. The orchestra kept sawing away at the Traviata music, so joyous and sad, so thin and far away, so claptrap and yet so heartbreaking. After the second act, I left Lena in tearful contemplation of the ceiling and went out into the lobby to smoke. As I walked about there, I congratulated myself that I had not brought some Lincoln girl who would talk during the waits about the junior dances or whether the cadets would camp at Plattsmouth. Lena was at least a woman, and I was a man. Though the scene between Marguerite and the elder Duval, Lena wept unceasingly, and I sat helpless to prevent the closing of that chapter of idyllic love, dreading the return of the young man whose ineffable happiness was only to be the measure of his fall. I suppose no woman could have been further in person, voice, and temperament from Dumas' appealing heroine than the veteran actress who first acquainted me with her. Her conception of the character was as heavy and uncompromising as her diction. She bore hard on the idea and on the consonants. At all times, she was highly tragic, devoured by remorse. Lightness of stress or behavior was far from her. Her voice was heavy and deep. "Armand!" she would begin, as if she were summoning him to the bar of judgment. But the lines were enough. She had only to utter them. They created the character in spite of her. The heartless world which Marguerite re-entered with Varville had never been so glittering and reckless as on the night when it gathered in Olympe's salon for the fourth act. There were chandeliers hung from the ceiling, I remember, many servants in livery, gaming tables where the men played with piles of gold, and a staircase down which the guests made their entrance. After all the others had gathered round the card tables and young Duval had been warned by Prudence, Marguerite descended the staircase with Varville. Such a cloak, such a fan, such jewels, and her face! One knew at a glance how it was with her. When Armand, with the terrible words, "Look, all of you, I owe this woman nothing," flung the gold and banknotes at the half-swooning Marguerite, Lena cowered beside me and covered her face with her hands. The curtain rose on the bedroom scene. By this time, there wasn't a nerve in me that hadn't been twisted. Nanine alone could have made me cry. I loved Nanine tenderly, and Gaston, how one clung to that good fellow. The New Year's presents were not too much. Nothing could be too much now. I wept unrestrainedly. Even the handkerchief in my breast pocket, worn for elegance and not at all for use, was wet through by the time that moribund woman sank for the last time into the arms of her lover. When we reached the door of the theater, the streets were shining with rain. I had prudently brought along Mrs. Harling's useful commencement present, and I took Lena home under its shelter. After leaving her, I walked slowly out into the country part of the town where I lived. The lilacs were all blooming in the yards, and the smell of them after the rain, of the new leaves and the blossoms together, blew into my face with a sort of bitter sweetness. I tramped through the puddles and under the showery trees, mourning for Marguerite Gautier as if she had died only yesterday, sighing with the spirit of 1840, which had sighed so much, and which had reached me only that night, across long years and several languages, through the person of an infirm old actress. The idea is one that no circumstances can frustrate. Wherever and whenever that piece is put on, it is April. Chapter 4. How well I remember the stiff little parlor where I used to wait for Lena, the hard horsehair furniture bought at some auction sale, the long mirror, the fashion plates on the wall. If I sat down even for a moment, I was sure to find threads and bits of colored silk clinging to my clothes after I went away. Lena's success puzzled me. She was so easygoing, had none of the push and self-assertiveness that get people ahead in business. She had come to Lincoln, a country girl, with no introductions except to some cousins of Mrs. Thomas who lived there, and she was already making clothes for the women of the young married set. Evidently, she had great natural aptitude for her work. She knew, as she said, what people looked well in. She never tired of poring over fashion books. Sometimes in the evening I would find her alone in her workroom, draping folds of satin on a wire figure, with a quite blissful expression of countenance. I couldn't help thinking that the years when Lena literally hadn't enough clothes to cover herself might have something to do with her untiring interest in dressing the human figure. Her clients said that Lena had style and overlooked her habitual inaccuracies. She never, I discovered, finished anything by the time she had promised, and she frequently spent more money on materials than her customer had authorized. Once, when I arrived at 6 o'clock, Lena was ushering out a fidgety mother and her awkward, overgrown daughter. The woman detained Lena at the door to say apologetically,
"You'll try to keep it under 50 for me, won't you, Miss Lingard? You see, she's really too young to come to an expensive dressmaker, but I knew you could do more with her than anybody else."
"Oh, that will be all right, Mrs. Heron. I think we'll manage to get a good effect," Lena replied blandly. I thought her manner with her customers very good, and wondered where she had learned such self-possession. Sometimes after my morning classes were over, I used to encounter Lena downtown in her velvet suit and a little black hat, with a veil tied smoothly over her face, looking as fresh as the spring morning. Maybe she would be carrying home a bunch of jonquils or a hyacinth plant. When we passed a candy store, her footsteps would hesitate and linger.
"Don't let me go in," she would murmur. "Get me by if you can."
She was very fond of sweets and was afraid of growing too plump. We had delightful Sunday breakfast together at Lena's. At the back of her long workroom was a bay window, large enough to hold a box couch and a reading table. We breakfasted in this recess, after drawing the curtains that shut out the long room, with cutting tables and wire women in sheet-draped garments on the walls. The sunlight poured in, making everything on the table shine and glitter, and the flame of the alcohol lamp disappear altogether. Lena's curly black water spaniel, Prince, breakfasted with us. He sat beside her on the couch and behaved very well until the Polish violin teacher across the hall began to practice, when Prince would growl and sniff the air with disgust. Lena's landlord, old Colonel Raleigh, had given her the dog, and at first she was not at all pleased. She had spent too much of her life taking care of animals to have much sentiment about them, but Prince was a knowing little beast, and she grew fond of him. After breakfast, I made him do his lessons, play dead dog, shake hands, stand up like a soldier. We used to put my cadet cap on his head, I had to take military drill at the university, and give him a yard measure to hold with his front leg. His gravity made us laugh immoderately. Lena's talk always amused me. Antonia had never talked like the people about her. Even after she learned to speak English readily, there was always something impulsive and foreign in her speech. But Lena had picked up all the conventional expressions she heard at Mrs. Thomas's dressmaking shop. Those formal phrases, the very flower of small-town proprieties, and the flat commonplaces, nearly all hypocritical in their origin, became very funny, very engaging when they were uttered in Lena's soft voice, with her caressing intonation and her arch naivete. Nothing could be more diverting than to hear Lena, who was almost as candid as nature, call a leg a limb, or a house a home. We used to linger a long while over our coffee in that sunny corner. Lena was never so pretty as in the morning. She wakened fresh with the world every day, and her eyes had a deeper color then, like the blue flowers that are never so blue as when they first open. I could sit idle all through a Sunday morning and look at her. Ole Benson's behavior was now no mystery to me.
"There was never any harm in Ole," she said once. "People needn't have troubled themselves. He just liked to come over and sit on the draw side and forget about his bad luck.
I like to have him. Any company's welcome when you're off with cattle all the time." "But wasn't he always glum?" I asked. "People said he never talked at all."
"Sure he talked, in Norwegian.
He'd been a sailor on an English boat and had seen lots of queer places. He had wonderful tattoos. We used to sit and look at them for hours. There wasn't much to look at out there. He was like a picture book. He had a ship and a strawberry girl on one arm, and on the other a girl standing before a little house, with a fence and gate and all, waiting for her sweetheart. Farther up his arm, her sailor had come back and was kissing her. The sailor's return, he called it." I admitted it was no wonder Oldie liked to look at a pretty girl once in a while, with such a fright at home.
"You know," Lena said confidentially, "he married Mary because he thought she was strong-minded and would keep him straight.
He could never keep straight on shore. The last time he landed in Liverpool, he'd been out on a 2 years' voyage. He was paid off one morning, and by the next he hadn't a cent left, and his watch and compass were gone. He'd got with some women, and they'd taken everything. He'd worked his way to this country on a little passenger boat. Mary was a stewardess, and she tried to convert him on the way over. He thought she was just the one to keep him steady. Poor Ole! He used to bring me candy from town, hidden in his feed bag.
He couldn't refuse anything to a girl. He'd have given away his tattoos long ago if he could. He's one of the people I'm sorriest for. If I happened to spend an evening with Lena and stayed late, the Polish violin teacher across the hall used to come out and watch me descend the stairs, muttering so threateningly that it would have been easy to fall into a quarrel with him. Lena had told him once that she liked to hear him practice, so he always left his door open and watched who came and went. There was a coolness between the Pole and Lena's landlord on her account. Old Colonel Raleigh had come to Lincoln from Kentucky and invested an inherited fortune in real estate at the time of inflated prices. Now he sat day after day in his office in the Raleigh block, trying to discover where his money had gone and how he could get some of it back. He was a widower and found very little congenial companionship in this casual western city. Lena's good looks and gentle manners appealed to him. He said her voice reminded him of southern voices, and he found as many opportunities of hearing it as possible. He painted and papered her rooms for her that spring, and put in a porcelain bathtub in place of the tin one that had satisfied the former tenant. While these repairs were being made, the old gentleman often dropped in to consult Lena's preferences. She told me with amusement how Ordinsky, the Pole, had presented himself at her door one evening and said that if the landlord was annoying her by his attentions, he would promptly put a stop to it. "I don't exactly know what to do about him," she said, shaking her head. "He's so sort of wild all the time. I wouldn't like to have him say anything rough to that nice old man. The colonel is long-winded, but I expect he's lonesome. I don't think he cares much for Ordinsky either. He said once that if I had any complaints to make of my neighbors, I mustn't hesitate." One Saturday evening when I was having supper with Lena, we heard a knock at her parlor door, and there stood the Pole, coatless, in a dress shirt and collar. Prince dropped on his paws and began to growl like a mastiff, while the visitor apologized, saying that he could not possibly come in thus attired, but he begged Lena to lend him some safety pins. "Oh, you'll have to come in, Mr. Ordinsky, and let me see what's the matter." She closed the door behind him. "Jim, won't you make Prince behave?" I rapped Prince on the nose, while Ordinsky explained that he had not had his dress clothes on for a long time, and tonight, when he was going to play for a concert, his waistcoat had split down the back. He thought he could pin it together until he got it to a tailor. Lena took him by the elbow and turned him around. She laughed when she saw the long gap in the satin. "You could never pin that, Mr. Ordinsky. You've kept it folded too long, and the goods is all gone along the crease. Take it off. I can put a new piece of lining silk in there for you in 10 minutes. She disappeared into her workroom with a vest, leaving me to confront the Pole, who stood against the door like a wooden figure. He folded his arms and glared at me with his excitable, slanting brown eyes. His head was the shape of a chocolate drop, and was covered with dry, straw-colored hair that fuzzed up about his pointed crown. He had never done more than mutter at me as I passed him, and I was surprised when he now addressed me. "Miss Lingard," he said haughtily, "is a young woman for whom I have the utmost respect."
"So have I," I said coldly.
He paid no heed to my remark, but began to do rapid finger exercises on his shirt sleeves as he stood with tightly folded arms.
"Kindness of heart," he went on, staring at the ceiling, "sentiment are not understood in a place like this. The noblest qualities are ridiculed. Grinning college boys, ignorant and conceited, what do they know of delicacy?"
I controlled my features and tried to speak seriously.
"If you mean me, Mr. Ordinsky, I have known Miss Lingard a long time, and I think I appreciate her kindness. We come from the same town, and we grew up together." His gaze traveled slowly down from the ceiling and rested on me.
"Am I to understand that you have this young woman's interests at heart? That you do not wish to compromise her?"
"That's a word we don't use much here, Mr. Ordinsky. A girl who makes her own living can ask a college boy to supper without being talked about. We take some things for granted."
"Then I have misjudged you, and I ask your pardon."
He bowed gravely.
"Miss Lingard," he went on, "is an absolutely trustful heart. She has not learned the hard lessons of life. As for you and me, noblesse oblige."
He watched me narrowly. Lena returned with the vest. "Come in and let us look at you as you go out, Mr. Ordinsky. I've never seen you in your dress suit," she said as she opened the door for him. A few moments later he reappeared with his violin case, a heavy muffler about his neck and thick woolen gloves on his bony hands. Lena spoke encouragingly to him, and he went off with such an important professional air that we fell to laughing as soon as we had shut the door.
"Poor fellow," Lena said indulgently. "He takes everything so hard."
After that, Ordinsky was friendly to me and behaved as if there was some deep understanding between us. He wrote a furious article attacking the musical taste of the town and asked me to do him a great service by taking it to the editor of the morning paper. If the editor refused to print it, I was to tell him that he would be answerable to Ordinsky in person. He declared that he would never retract one word and that he was quite prepared to lose all his pupils. In spite of the fact that nobody ever mentioned his article to him after it appeared, full of typographical errors which he thought intentional, he got a certain satisfaction from believing that the citizens of Lincoln had meekly accepted the epithet "coarse barbarians."
"You see how it is," he said to me. "Where there is no chivalry, there is no amour propre."
When I met him on his rounds now, I thought he carried his head more disdainfully than ever, and strode up the steps of front porches and rang doorbells with more assurance. He told Lena he would never forget how I had stood by him when he was under fire. All this time, of course, I was drifting. Lena had broken up my serious mood. I wasn't interested in my classes. I played with Lena and Prince. I played with the pole. I went buggy riding with the old colonel who had taken a fancy to me and used to talk to me about Lena and the great beauties he had known in his youth. We were all three in love with Lena. Before the 1st of June, Gaston Cleric was offered an instructorship at Harvard College and accepted it. He suggested that I should follow him in the fall and complete my course at Harvard. He had found out about Lena, not from me, and he talked to me seriously. "You won't do anything here now. You should either quit school and go to work, or change your college and begin again in earnest. You won't recover yourself while you are playing about with this handsome Norwegian. Yes, I've seen it with you at the theater. She's very pretty and perfectly irresponsible, I should judge." Cleric wrote my grandfather that he would like to take me east with him. To my astonishment, grandfather replied that I might go if I wished. I was both glad and sorry on the day when the letter came. I stayed in my room all evening and thought things over. I even tried to persuade myself that I was standing in Lena's way. It is so necessary to be a little noble, and that if she had not me to play with, she would probably marry and secure her future. The next evening I went to call on Lena. I found her propped up on the couch in her bay window with her foot in a big slipper. An awkward little Russian girl whom she had taken into her workroom had dropped a flat iron on Lena's toe. On the table beside her there was a basket of early summer flowers which the Pole had left after he heard of the accident. He always managed to know what went on in Lena's apartment. Lena was telling me some amusing piece of gossip about one of her clients when I interrupted her and picked up the flower basket. "This old chap will be proposing to you some day, Lena."
"Oh, he has. Often," she murmured.
"What, after you've refused him?"
"He doesn't mind that. It seems to cheer him to mention the subject. Old men are like that, you know. It makes them feel important to think they're in love with somebody."
"The colonel would marry you in a minute. I hope you won't marry some old fellow, not even a rich one."
Lena shifted her pillows and looked up at me in surprise.
"Why, I'm not going to marry anybody. Didn't you know that?"
"Nonsense, Lena. That's what girls say, but you know better. Every handsome girl like you marries, of course."
She shook her head.
"Not me."
"But why not? What makes you say that?" I persisted.
Lena laughed.
"Well, it's mainly because I don't want a husband.
Men are all right for friends, but as soon as you marry them, they turn into cranky old fathers, even the wild ones. They begin to tell you what's sensible and what's foolish, and want you to stick at home all the time. I prefer to be foolish when I feel like it, and be accountable to nobody."
"But you'll be lonesome. You'll get tired of this sort of life, and you'll want a family."
"Not me. I like to be lonesome. When I went to work for Mrs. Thomas, I was 19 years old, and I had never slept a night in my life when there weren't three in the bed. I never had a minute to myself except when I was off with the cattle."
Usually, when Lena referred to her life in the country at all, she dismissed it with a single remark, humorous or mildly cynical. but tonight her mind seemed to dwell on those early years. She told me she couldn't remember a time when she was so little that she wasn't lugging a heavy baby about, helping to wash for babies, trying to keep their little chapped hands and faces clean. She remembered home as a place where there were always too many children, a cross man, and work piling up around a sick woman. It wasn't Mother's fault. She would have made us comfortable if she could. But that was no life for a girl. After I began to herd milk, I could never get the smell of the cattle off me. The few underclothes I had I kept in a cracker box. On Saturday nights, after everybody was in bed, then I could take a bath if I wasn't too tired. I could make 2 trips to the windmill to carry water and heat it in the wash boiler on the stove. While the water was heating, I could bring in a wash tub out of the cave and take my bath in the kitchen. Then I could put on a clean nightgown and get into bed with 2 others who likely hadn't had a bath unless I'd given it to them. You can't tell me anything about family life. I've had plenty to last me. But it's not all like that, I objected. Near enough. It's all being under somebody's thumb. What's on your mind, Jim? Are you afraid I'll want you to marry me someday? Then I told her I was going away. What makes you want to go away, Jim? Haven't I been nice to you? You've been just awfully good to me, Lena, I blurted. I don't think about much else. I never shall think about much else while I'm with you. I'll never settle down and grind if I stay here. You know that. I dropped down beside her and sat looking at the floor. I seemed to have forgotten all my reasonable explanations. Lena drew close to me, and the little hesitation in her voice that had hurt me was not there when she spoke again. I oughtn't to have begun it, ought I? She murmured. I oughtn't to have gone to see you that first time. But I did want to. I guess I've always been a little foolish about you. I don't know what first put it into my head, unless it was Antonia always telling me I mustn't be up to any of my nonsense with you. I let you alone for a long while, though, didn't I? She was a sweet creature to those she loved, that Lena Lingard. At last she sent me away with her soft, slow, renunciatory kiss. You aren't sorry I came to see you that time? She whispered. It seems so natural. I used to think I'd like to be your first sweetheart. You were such a funny kid. She always kissed one as if she were sadly and wisely sending one away forever. We said many goodbyes before I left Lincoln, but she never tried to hinder me or hold me back. You are going, but you haven't gone yet, have you? She used to say. My Lincoln chapter closed abruptly. I went home to my grandparents for a few weeks, and afterward visited my relatives in Virginia until I joined Cleric in Boston. I was then 19 years old. Book 4. The Pioneer Woman's Story. Chapter 1. 2 years after I left Lincoln, I completed my academic course at Harvard. Before I entered the law school, I went home for the summer vacation. On the night of my arrival, Mrs. Harling and Francis and Sally came over to greet me. Everything seemed just as it used to be. My grandparents looked very little older. Francis Harling was married now, and she and her husband managed the Harling interests in Blackhawk. When we gathered in Grandmother's parlor, I could hardly believe that I had been away at all. One subject, however, we avoided all evening. When I was walking home with Francis after we had left Mrs. Harling at her gate, she said simply, "You know, of course, about poor Antonia." Poor Antonia! Everyone would be saying that now, I thought bitterly. I replied that Grandmother had written me how Antonia went away to marry Larry Donovan at some place where he was working, that he had deserted her, and that there was now a baby. This was all I knew. "He never married her," Francis said. "I haven't seen her since she came back. She lives at home on the farm and almost never comes to town. She brought the baby in to show it to Mama once. I'm afraid she's settled down to be Ambrose's drudge for good." I tried to shut Antonia out of my mind. I was bitterly disappointed in her. I could not forgive her for becoming an object of pity, while Lena Lingard, for whom people had always foretold trouble, was now the leading dressmaker of Lincoln, much respected in Blackhawk. Lena gave her heart away when she felt like it, but she kept her head for her business and had got on in the world. Just then it was the fashion to speak indulgently of Lena and severely of Tiny Soderball, who had quietly gone west to try her fortune the year before. A Blackhawk boy, just back from Seattle, brought the news that Tiny had not gone to the coast on a venture, as she had allowed people to think, but with very definite plans. One of the roving promoters that used to stop at Mrs. Gardner's hotel owned idle property along the waterfront in Seattle, and he had offered to set Tiny up in business in one of his empty buildings. She was now conducting a sailor's lodging house. This, everyone said, would be the end of Tiny. Even as she had begun by running a decent place, she couldn't keep it up. All sailors' boarding houses were alike. When I thought about it, I discovered that I had never known Tiny as well as I knew the other girls. I remembered her tripping briskly about the dining room on her high heels, carrying a big trayful of dishes, glancing rather pertly at the spruce traveling men, and contemptuously at the scrubby ones, who were so afraid of her that they didn't dare ask for two kinds of pie. Now it occurred to me that perhaps the sailors, too, might be afraid of Tiny. How astonished we should have been, as we sat talking about her on Frances Harling's front porch, if we could have known what her future was really to be. Of all the girls and boys who grew up together in Blackhawk, Tiny Soderball was to lead the most adventurous life and to achieve the most solid worldly success. This is what actually happened to Tiny. While she was running her lodging house in Seattle, gold was discovered in Alaska. Miners and sailors came back from the north with wonderful stories and pouches of gold. Tiny saw it and weighed it in her hands. That daring, which nobody had ever suspected in her, awoke. She sold her business and set out for Circle City in company with a carpenter and his wife whom she had persuaded to go along with her. They reached Skagway in a snowstorm, went in dog sledges over the Chilkoot Pass, and shot the Yukon in flatboats. They reached Circle City on the very day when some Siwash Indians came into the settlement with the report that there had been a rich gold strike farther up the river on a certain Klondike Creek. 2 days later, Tiny and her friends, and nearly everyone else in Circle City, started for the Klondike Fields on the last steamer that went up the Yukon before it froze for the winter. That boatload of people founded Dawson City. Within a few weeks, there were 1,500 homeless men in camp. Tiny and the carpenter's wife began to cook for them, in a tent. The miners gave her a building lot, and the carpenter put up a log hotel for her. There she sometimes fed 150 men a day. Miners came in on snowshoes from their placer claims 20 miles away to buy fresh bread from her, and paid for it in gold. That winter, Tiny kept in her hotel a Swede whose legs had been frozen one night in a storm when he was trying to find his way back to his cabin. The poor fellow thought it great good fortune to be cared for by a woman, and a woman who spoke his own tongue. When he was told that his feet must be amputated, he said he hoped he would not get well. What could a working man do in this hard world without feet? He did, in fact, die from the operation, but not before he had deeded Tiny Soderball his claim on Hunker Creek. Tiny sold her hotel, invested half her money in Dawson building lots, and with the rest, she developed her claim. She went off into the wilds and lived on the claim. She bought other claims from discouraged miners, traded or sold them on percentages. After nearly 10 years in the Klondike, Tiny returned, with a considerable fortune, to live in San Francisco. I met her in Salt Lake City in 1908. She was a thin, hard-faced woman, very well-dressed, very reserved in manner. Curiously enough, she reminded me of Mrs. Gardner, for whom she had worked in Blackhawk so long ago. She told me about some of the desperate chances she had taken in the gold country, but the thrill of them was quite gone. She said frankly that nothing interested her much now but making money. The only two human beings of whom she spoke with any feeling were the Swede, Johnson, who had given her his claim, and Lena Lingard. She had persuaded Lena to come to San Francisco and go into business there.
"Lincoln was never any place for her," Tiny remarked. "In a town of that size, Lena would always be gossiped about. Frisco's the right field for her. She has a fine class of trade. Oh, she's just the same as she always was. She's careless, but she's level-headed. She's the only person I know who never gets any older. It's fine for me to have her there, somebody who enjoys things like that. She keeps an eye on me and won't let me get shabby. When she thinks I need a new dress, she makes it and sends it home, with a bill that's long enough, I can tell you." Tiny limped slightly when she walked. The claim on Hunker Creek took toll from its possessors. Tiny had been caught in a sudden turn of weather, like poor Johnson. She lost 3 toes from one of those pretty little feet that used to trip about Blackhawk in pointed slippers and striped stockings.
Tiny mentioned this mutilation quite casually, didn't seem sensitive about it. She was satisfied with her success, but not elated. She was like someone in whom the faculty of becoming interested is worn out.
Chapter 2. Soon after I got home that summer, I persuaded my grandparents to have their photographs taken, and one morning I went into the photographer's shop to arrange for sittings. While I was waiting for him to come out of his developing room, I walked about trying to recognize the likenesses on his walls. Girls in commencement dresses, country brides and grooms holding hands, family groups of three generations. I noticed, in a heavy frame, one of those depressing crayon enlargements often seen in farmhouse parlors, the subject being a round-eyed baby in short dresses. The photographer came out and gave a constrained, apologetic laugh. "That's Tony Schemerda's baby. You remember her. She used to be the Harlings' Tony. Too bad. She seems proud of the baby, though. Wouldn't hear to a cheap frame for the picture. I expect her brother will be in for it Saturday." I went away feeling that I must see Antonia again. Another girl would have kept her baby out of sight, but Tony, of course, must have its picture on exhibition at the town photographer's in a great gilt frame. How like her! I could forgive her, I told myself, if she hadn't thrown herself away on such a cheap sort of fellow. Larry Donovan was a passenger conductor, one of those train crew aristocrats who are always afraid that someone may ask them to put up a car window, and who, if requested to perform such a menial service, silently point to the button that calls the porter. Larry wore this air of official aloofness even on the street, where there were no car windows to compromise his dignity. At the end of his run, he stepped indifferently from the train along with the passengers, his street hat on his head and his conductor's cap in an alligator skin bag, went directly into the station, and changed his clothes. It was a matter of the utmost importance to him never to be seen in his blue trousers away from his train. He was usually cold and distant with men, but with all women he had a silent, grave familiarity, a special handshake, accompanied by a significant, deliberate look. He took women, married or single, into his confidence, walked them up and down in the moonlight, telling them what a mistake he had made by not entering the office branch of the service, and how much better fitted he was to fill the post of general passenger agent in Denver than the roughshod man who then bore that title. His unappreciated worth was the tender secret Larry shared with his sweethearts, and he was always able to make some foolish heart ache over it. As I drew home that morning, I saw Mrs. Harling out in her yard, digging round her mountain ash tree. It was a dry summer, and she had now no boy to help her. Charlie was off in his battleship, cruising somewhere on the Caribbean Sea. I turned in at the gate. It was with a feeling of pleasure that I opened and shut that gate in those days. I liked the feel of it under my hand. I took the spade away from Mrs. Harling, and while I loosened the earth around the tree, she sat down on the steps and talked about the oriole family that had a nest in its branches. "Mrs. Harling," I said presently, "I wish I could find out exactly how Antonia's marriage fell through." "Why don't you go out and see your grandfather's tenant, the Widow Stevens? She knows more about it than anybody else. She helped Antonia get ready to be married, and she was there when Antonia came back. She took care of her when the baby was born. She could tell you everything. Besides, the Widow Stevens is a good talker, and she has a remarkable memory." Chapter 3. On the first or second day of August, I got a horse and cart and set out for the high country to visit the Widow Stevens. The wheat harvest was over, and here and there along the horizon I could see black puffs of smoke from the steam threshing machines. The old pasture land was now being broken up into wheat fields and cornfields. The red grass was disappearing, and the whole face of the country was changing. There were wooden houses where the old sod dwellings used to be, and little orchards and big red barns. All this meant happy children, contented women, and men who saw their lives coming to a fortunate issue. The windy springs and the blazing summers, one after another, had enriched and mellowed that flat tableland. All the human effort that had gone into it was coming back in long, sweeping lines of fertility. The changes seemed beautiful and harmonious to me. It was like watching the growth of a great man or of a great idea. I recognized every tree and sandbank and rugged draw.
I found that I remembered the conformation of the land as one remembers the modeling of human faces. When I drew up to our old windmill, the widow Stevens came out to meet me. She was brown as an Indian woman, tall and very strong. When I was little, her massive head had always seemed to me like a Roman senator's. I told her at once why I had come.
"You'll stay the night with us, Jimmy. I'll talk to you after supper. I can take more interest when my work is off my mind. You've no prejudice against hot biscuit for supper. Some have these days."
While I was putting my horse away, I heard a rooster squawking. I looked at my watch and sighed. It was 3 o'clock, and I knew that I must eat him at 6. After supper, Mrs. Stevens and I went upstairs to the old sitting room while her grave, silent brother remained in the basement to read his farm papers. All the windows were open. The white summer moon was shining outside. The windmill was pumping lazily in the light breeze. My hostess put the lamp on a stand in the corner and turned it low because of the heat. She sat down in her favorite rocking chair and settled a little stool comfortably under her tired feet.
"I'm troubled with calluses, Jim. Getting old," she sighed cheerfully.
She crossed her hands in her lap and sat as if she were at a meeting of some kind.
"Now, it's about that dear Antonia you want to know. Well, you've come to the right person. I've watched her like she'd been my own daughter. When she came home to do her sewing that summer before she was to be married, she was over here about every day. They've never had a sewing machine at the Shemerdas, and she made all her things here. I taught her hem-stitching, and I helped her to cut and fit. She used to sit there at that machine by the window, peddling the life out of it. She was so strong, and always singing them queer bohemian songs, like she was the happiest thing in the world. 'Antonia,' I used to say, 'don't run that machine so fast. You won't hasten the day none that way.' Then she'd laugh and slow down for a little, but she'd soon forget and begin to peddle and sing again. I never saw a girl work harder to go to housekeeping right and well prepared. Lovely table linen the Harlins had given her, and Lena Lingard had sent her nice things from Lincoln. We hem-stitched all the tablecloths and pillowcases and some of the sheets. Old Mrs. Shemer had knit yards and yards of lace for her underclothes. Tony told me just how she meant to have everything in her house. She even bought silver spoons and forks and kept them in her trunk. She was always coaxing brother to go to the post office. Her young man did ride her real often from the different towns along his run. The first thing that troubled her was when he wrote that his run had been changed, and they would likely have to live in Denver. 'I'm a country girl,' she said, 'and I doubt if I'll be able to manage so well for him in a city. I was counting on keeping chickens and maybe a cow.' She soon cheered up, though. At last she got the letter telling her when to come. She was shaken by it. She broke the seal and read it in this room. I suspected then that she'd begun to get faint-hearted, waiting, though she'd never let me see it. Then there was a great time of packing. It was in March, if I remember rightly, and a terrible, muddy, raw spell with the roads bad for hauling her things to town. And here, let me say, Ambrose did the right thing. He went to Black Hawk and bought her a set of plated silver and a purple velvet box, good enough for her station. He gave her $300 in money. I saw the check. He'd collected her wages all those first years she worked out, and it was but right. I shook him by the hand in this room. 'You're behaving like a man, Ambrose,' I said, 'and I'm glad to see it, son.' 'Twas a cold, raw day he drove her and her three trunks into Black Hawk to take the night train for Denver. The boxes had been shipped before. He stopped the wagon here, and she ran to tell me goodbye. She threw her arms around me and kissed me and thanked me for all I'd done for her. She was so happy she was crying and laughing at the same time, and her red cheeks was all wet with rain. 'You're surely handsome enough for any man,' I said, looking her over. She laughed kind of flighty-like and whispered, 'Goodbye, dear house,' and then ran out to the wagon. I expect she meant that for you and your grandmother as much as for me, so I'm particular to tell you. This house had always been a refuge to her. Well, in a few days we had a letter saying she got to Denver safe, and he was there to meet her. They were to be married in a few days. He was trying to get his promotion before he married, she said. I didn't like that, but I said nothing. The next week Yulka got a postal card saying she was well and happy. After that we heard nothing. A month went by, and old Mrs. Shemerda began to get fretful.
Ambrose was as sulky with me as if I'd picked out the man and arranged the match. One night, Brother William came in and said that on his way back from the fields he had passed a livery team from town driving fast out the west road. There was a trunk on the front seat with the driver and another behind. In the back seat there was a woman all bundled up, but for all her veils he thought 'twas Antonia Shimerder, or Antonia Donovan, as her name ought now to be. The next morning I got Brother to drive me over. I can walk still, but my feet ain't what they used to be, and I try to save myself. The lines outside the Shimerder's house was full of washing, though it was middle of the week. As we got nearer, I saw a sight that made my heart sink. All those underclothes we'd put so much work on out there swinging in the wind. Yulka came bringing a dishpan full of wrung clothes, but she darted back into the house like she was loath to see us. When I went in, Antonia was standing over the tubs, just finishing up a big washing. Mrs. Shimerder was going about her work, talking and scolding to herself. She didn't so much as raise her eyes. Tony wiped her hand on her apron and held it out to me, looking at me steady but mournful. When I took her in my arms, she drew away. "Don't, Mrs. Stevens," she says. "You make me cry, and I don't want to." I whispered and asked her to come out of doors with me. I knew she couldn't talk free before her mother. She went out with me bareheaded, and we walked up toward the garden. "I'm not married, Mrs. Stevens," she says to me, very quiet and natural-like, "and I ought to be." "Oh, my child," says I, "what's happened to you? Don't be afraid to tell me." She sat down on the draw side out of sight of the house. "He's run away from me," she said. "I don't know if he ever meant to marry me." "You mean he's thrown up his job and quit the country?" says I. "He didn't have any job. He'd been fired, blacklisted for knocking down fares. I didn't know. I thought he hadn't been treated right. He was sick when I got there. He'd just come out of the hospital. He lived with me till my money gave out, and afterward I found out he hadn't really been hunting work at all. Then he just didn't come back. One nice fellow at the station told me, when I kept going to look for him, to give it up. He said he was afraid Larry'd gone bad and wouldn't come back any more. I guess he'd gone to old Mexico. The conductors get rich down there, collecting half fares off the natives and robbing the company. He was always talking about fellows who had got ahead that way. I asked her, of course, why she didn't insist on a civil marriage at once. That would have given her some hold on him. She leaned her head on her hands, poor child, and said, "I just don't know, Mrs. Stevens. I guess my patience was wore out, waiting so long. I thought if he saw how well I could do for him, he'd want to stay with me." Jimmy, I sat right down on that bank beside her and made lament. I cried like a young thing. I couldn't help it. I was just about heartbroke. It was one of them lovely warm May days, and the wind was blowing and the colts jumping around in the pastures, but I felt bowed with despair. My Antonia, that had so much good in her, had come home disgraced, and that Lena Lingard, that was always a bad one, say what you will, had turned out so well, and was coming home here every summer in her silks and her satins, and doing so much for her mother. I give credit where credit is due. But you know well enough, Jim Burden, there is a great difference in the principles of those two girls. And here it was the good one that had come to grief. I was poor comfort for her. I marveled at her calm. As we went back to the house, she stopped to feel of her clothes to see if they was drying well, and seemed to take pride in their whiteness. She said she'd been living in a brick block where she didn't have proper conveniences to wash them. The next time I saw Antonia, she was out in the fields plowing corn. All that spring and summer she did the work of a man on the farm. It seemed to be an understood thing. Ambrose didn't get any other hand to help him. Poor Merrick had got violent and been sent away to an institution a good while back. We never even saw any of Tony's pretty dresses. She didn't take them out of her trunks. She was quiet and steady. Folks respected her industry and tried to treat her as if nothing had happened. They talked, to be sure, but not like they would if she'd put on airs. She was so crushed and quiet that nobody seemed to want to humble her. She never went anywhere. All that summer she never once came to see me. At first I was hurt, but I got to feel that it was because this house reminded her of too much. I went over there when I could, but the times when she was in from the fields were the times when I was busiest here. She talked about the grain and the weather as if she'd never had another interest, and if I went over at night, she always looked dead weary. She was afflicted with toothache. One tooth after another ulcerated, and she went about with her face swollen half the time. She wouldn't go to Black Hawk to a dentist for fear of meeting people she knew. Ambrose had got over his good spell long ago and was always surly. Once I told him he ought not to let Antonia work so hard and pull herself down. He said, "If you put that in her head, you better stay home." And after that I did. Antonia worked on through harvest and threshing, though she was too modest to go out threshing for the neighbors, like when she was young and free. I didn't see much of her until late that fall, when she begun to herd Ambrose's cattle in the open ground north of here, up toward the big dog town. Sometimes she used to bring them over the west hill there, and I would run to meet her and walk north a piece with her. She had 30 cattle in her bunch. It had been dry, and the pasture was short, or she wouldn't have brought them so far. It was a fine open fall, and she liked to be alone. While the steers grazed, she used to sit on them grassy banks along the draws and sun herself for hours. Sometimes I slipped up to visit with her when she hadn't gone too far. "It does seem like I ought to make lace, or knit like Lena used to," she said one day. "But if I start to work, I look around and forget to go on. It seems such a little while ago when Jim Burden and I was playing all over this country. Up here I can pick out the very places where my father used to stand. Sometimes I feel like I'm not going to live very long, so I'm just enjoying every day of this fall." After the winter begun, she wore a man's long overcoat and boots, and a man's felt hat with a wide brim. I used to watch her coming and going, and I could see that her steps were getting heavier. One day in December, the snow began to fall. Late in the afternoon, I saw Antonia driving her cattle homeward across the hill. The snow was flying around her, and she bent to face it, looking more lonesome-like to me than usual. "Deary me," I says to myself, "the girl stayed out too late. It'll be dark before she gets them cattle put into the corral." I seemed to sense she'd been feeling too miserable to get up and drive them. That very night, it happened. She got her cattle home, turned them into the corral, and went into the house, into her room behind the kitchen, and shut the door. There, without calling to anybody, without a groan, she lay down on the bed and bore her child. I was lifting supper when old Mrs. Schemeter came running down the basement stairs out of breath and screeching. "Baby come, baby come," she says. "Ambrose much like devil." Brother William is surely a patient man. He was just ready to sit down to a hot supper after a long day in the fields. Without a word, he rose and went down to the barn and hooked up his team. He got us over there as quick as it was humanly possible. I went right in and began to do for Antonia, but she laid there with her eyes shut and took no account of me. The old woman got a tub full of warm water to wash the baby. I overlooked what she was doing, and I said out loud, "Mrs. Schemeter, don't you put that strong yellow soap near that